This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Last weekend, Black Agenda Report celebrated its 7th anniversary at New York City's historic Riverside Church. Nellie Bailey was the master of ceremonies. The place was filled with friends and supporters of Barr and our extended political family. The theme of the event, the Black Misleadership Class versus the Black Movement and its Legacy. I thought it was appropriate to begin with the example of Cory Booker, the Newark, New Jersey mayor who was just elected to the U.S. Senate. Booker owes his career and financing to some of the most right-wing forces in the nation, including the Bradley Foundation of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He was there at the first meeting, the founding gathering in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, under the auspices of the Bradley Foundation, for a front group that they had specifically formed in order to try and create the impression that there was a movement out there among black folks for private school vouchers. Now, the reality was that private school vouchers had never been an issue in the black community. If people were familiar at all with private school vouchers, it was in the context of them being used in order to fund segregation academies in the Deep South during the time of massive resistance. But the Bradley Foundation reasoned that with their millions and millions of dollars, they could create a movement or the semblance of one out of a thin air. All they had to do was attract a gaggle of hustlers and scoundrels, black hustlers and scoundrels, and call them the thinkers and movers and shakers of a new movement, and it would be so. And all they had to do was tell the corporate media that this was a legitimate movement of black people, and they would cover it that way. Also on hand was Floyd Flake. He was the congressman from Queens who, before he resigned, was the only member of the Congressional Black Caucus who ever supported school vouchers. Floyd Flake went on to become an important cog in the wheel of the Manhattan Institute. All of you are familiar with that right-wing outfit, and to make millions as a practitioner of charter schools. Flake and Booker are part of a black misleadership class, however, one that is totally bought and paid for, created out of whole cloth by the corporate world. 3 years later, after Cory got his real political beginnings, after he put together the source of his funding, he made his first run for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. That was in 2002. He was backed with millions of dollars in campaign funds from that same universe of right-wingers that he had met through the Bradley Foundation. Even the right-wing columnist George F. Will came to Newark to support Cory Booker. This is how Cory Booker was set on the path to becoming a major black political figure as a wholly owned subsidiary of the most reactionary forces in the United States, as a pure servant of corporate power. And that year was 2002. That's when we first called attention at Black Commentator. Black Commentator was the predecessor to Black Agenda Report, and that's where the core of the Black Agenda Report team came together. And back in 2002, we were the first to call attention to the great danger that was represented not just by Cory Booker, but to all of these newly empowered hustlers and scoundrels who were being funded by the corporate world. That was the first issue, in fact, of the Black Commentator, the cover story for that first issue. It was called Fruit of the Poison Tree. The core team of Black Agenda Report has actually been documenting the rise of this new cohort of black corporate politicians for more than a decade, not just the 7 years that we're celebrating tonight of Black Agenda Report. The Black
Misleadership class is nothing new. It did not begin in 1998 or in 2002 or even with this surge of corporate funding. It has always been there. It has existed in some form as long as there has been a Black America. It is a class that sees its own personal, financial, and social interests as being synonymous with the progress of Black people as a whole. This class does not seek transformation of society. It seeks only their own elevation within the existing structures. The rest of Black America, as far as they are concerned, is supposed to applaud their individual success. And we're also supposed to call that Black progress, no matter what is actually happening to the masses of Black people at the bottom. It is the politics of putting Black faces in high places and to hell with those of us stuck at the bottom or those of us who are below the bottom in the U.S. prison gulag. This Black misleadership class has always been among us, and it is the tension between these representationists, these who see only the goal of being represented, that is, having a few Black folks in business and in motion pictures, and maybe one day, now is the day, in the White House, but do not see the need for a transformation of society. What's new is the massive influx of national corporate money to Black Democrats, and resulting in not just Cory Booker's candidacy, but others as well. It all begins in 2002 with Cory Booker's first campaign for mayor and the corporate-funded unseating of Cynthia McKinney in Atlanta and of Earl Hilliard in Alabama. These campaigns were funded by the same people that put Cory Booker up for office the first time. Corporate money transformed the Black electoral politics game, just as corporate money subverted the old line Black civic and civil rights organizations and made them into willing partners with the very same Wall Street banks that were, back in 2002, beginning to target every Black neighborhood in the nation with subprime mortgages. Corporate America begins the 21st century with a massive money offensive in Black America, and they were successful beyond their wildest dreams. They knew that they had a future star in Cory Booker, and they're so happy today. They're celebrating. Their boy is going to the Senate. But back in 2002, they were also vetting another and much more talented and much more promising front man for Capitol. And his name was Barack Obama. He was beginning his campaign for the Senate from Illinois. We at Black Commentator, when the team was there, we confronted Obama for a solid month in June of 2003, Bruce Dixon and I. We had an intense back and forth exchange with Brother Obama, which you can still read in the pages of the Black Commentator. We knew that Obama was a nightmare that was about to happen, but we did let him slide. We hoped that we could somehow avoid denouncing this up-and-coming young man that so many people found so attractive. But, of course, it didn't work that way. We couldn't avoid him for long. It was Barack Obama who wound up moving forward in astonishing speed Cory Booker's and the Bradley Foundation's agenda on the privatization of public schools. And one of Obama's first acts was to expand the faith-based initiatives. So we have the Bradley Foundation's initiative living on with Obama, just as the Heritage Foundation's legacy lives on in Obamacare. Cory Booker has gone on to climb into bed with every money bag in the Silicon Valley, But Barack Obama is the commander-in-chief of global capitalism, the imperial maestro with a kill list that has everybody's name and everybody's address on it, along with all of your social and political networks and friends. And all of this has been done with a black face. The transformation in black politics over the last 10 years has been staggering. It has been absolutely breathtaking. In 2002, when George Bush asked the U.S. Congress for war powers in order to attack Iraq, only 4 members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor. Our team at the Black Commentator called these 4 people the 4 eunuchs of war. Now, fast forward just 9 years to 2011, in the age of Obama, fully half of the Congressional Black Caucus, 20 members, voted against a resolution that would have halted the U.S. bombing of an African nation, Libya. This is an outcome that would have been unthinkable under George Bush just a few years before. It was even more grotesque when it's remembered that while these 20 black members of Congress were voting to continue bombing Libya, President Obama's jihadist rebel friends were carrying out a race war on the ground in Libya, purging the country of black Libyans and African migrants and massacring them by the thousands. But that didn't change the minds of half of the Congressional Black Caucus. Only a decade earlier, in 2003, just 6 weeks before the Iraq war began, the Zogby poll did a survey that found that only 21% of blacks supported an attack on Iraq. Huge majorities at the same time of white men were for the war, and majorities of white women and nearly half of Hispanics were also for a war against Iraq. But when the Zogby poll asked the question, would you support an invasion of Iraq if it would result in the death of thousands of Iraqi civilians, only 7% of blacks said yes. And that was a reaffirmation of what pollsters had found consistently ever since blacks have been included in the polling process. They have found that African Americans are the group most consistently opposed to U.S. military adventures abroad. And that is because, historically, we have not trusted the motives of the United States. And we never have. That is, until a black man came to sit in the White House. And suddenly, those motives were seen as benign. Now, fast forward again to September of this year. For the first time in history, more blacks said they were in favor of war than whites did. This has never happened before. 40% of blacks surveyed by the ABC Washington Post poll said they were in favor of a military strike against Syria. Only 38% of whites said so, and only 31% of Hispanics were in favor. The question then raised is this a repudiation by a sizable proportion of black folks of the historical black consensus on peace and on social justice? I don't think that it is a repudiation, but right now we can't prove whether it is or not. What is clear is that the age of Obama is offering up the worst role models in black American history, and a black political class that is quite willing to consign the black consensus on peace to the dustbin of history in order to defend a black presence in the highest office in the land. So go bomb the Libyans and go bomb the Syrians. We got a black man in the White House. What does it matter? A significant proportion of the black population is willing to go along with almost any program as long as they feel that they are acting or expressing opinions that are in defense of Obama. I'm going to leave you with one more horrific factoid. Fully one-third of the Black Caucus recently voted to maintain the NSA's spying program on all Americans. And to think, one-third of the caucus, people who are representing Black communities that are suffering mass incarceration and have been suffering mass incarceration for the last 40 years. And we understand that the beginning of the process of mass incarceration is hyper-surveillance of the Black community. And yet this one-third of the Black caucus votes for hyper-surveillance of all Americans. This is a monstrous deformity of Black politics, and it has occurred over just the last 10 years. It's rooted in the huge onslaught of corporate money into Black Democratic politics and in the suborning by corporations of traditional Black organizations. There is no movement to act as a countervailing force to the power of capital. And when there is no mass movement, the self-serving Black misleadership class becomes even more influential internally in Black America. Black Agenda Report exists to play a role in the rebuilding of a mass Black movement. And if there is no rebuilding of a mass Black movement, there is little hope of any effective progressive resistance to the rule of Wall Street and its servants in government and for peace. Some of you may say, Glenn, why all this lamentation? I thought this was supposed to be a celebration of Black Agenda's 7th anniversary, and you ain't smiled yet. But I think that we are celebrating. We're celebrating the fact that we are still here fighting the power every day. And that more and more people of all races are recognizing the real dimensions of the crisis and the character and nature of the crisis. We're celebrating the fact that there still exists a critical mass of people who are struggling to reestablish and repair the Black historical consensus for social justice and peace. And some of the most outstanding personalities in that struggle are right here with us tonight. We promised you a productive and worthwhile evening. Power to the people.
Good evening, and thanks for coming. I'm Bruce Dixon. At Black Agenda Report, we believe that something old and important is dying or already dead. There's a very important struggle in progress as to what is going to take its place. And this struggle about what's going to take its place is really central to the political life of Black America. This struggle is a very sharp kind of struggle, and there's little or no room, little or no time to sleep on it. There's no time to waste because sometimes dead things don't know or believe they're dead. Sometimes the people who relied and trusted those dead things don't believe they're dead either, and they continue to act as though they're not. Sometimes, like in the zombie pics, dead things or parts of them wake up almost immediately with a new and malevolent purpose, a mission quite different from what they had when they were alive. At Black Agenda Report, we call this the Black Misleadership Class, our name for a range of forces ranging from the undead corpses of the old civil rights organizations, which are now wholly funded by corporate America, to a large part of the Black church, and to our large tribe of Black elected and appointed officials, our judges, prosecutors, legislators, sheriffs, jailers, along with their consultants and contractors and aspirants. In an important sense, of course, these forces are far from dead. They're not dead any more than the zombies on TV are dead. Like them, they are actually, dead or not, quite active. What's dead and dying in our black misleadership class is any lingering pretense of an attachment to what used to be their mission of racial, let alone human, uplift. As Glenn said, they're dedicated now to their own careers and to the advancement of others like them. 45 years ago, there were only 6 or 7 black faces in Congress, and there were no black behinds in the big chairs of city halls, speakers of state houses, presidents of state senates, let alone in the White House. There were no black secretaries of state or UN ambassadors or national security advisors. Back in the 60s, 45 years ago, black unemployment was twice that of whites. Rural land loss and urban gentrification were huge, huge problems 45 years ago facing black America. White people in 1965 were a majority in U.S. prisons and jails, although blacks were certainly already overrepresented. Fast forward 45 years to the new century, black unemployment is still twice that of whites. But what we do have is we have a large and prosperous and self-celebrating and entrenched black political class who are not just domestic players but international players. John Kerry is the first white Secretary of State in, 12, 15 years now. Andy Young was one of Dr. King's inner circle. He was the one they used to joke about being the one most likely to sell out. In the early 70s, Andy went straight to Congress. Afterwards, he became UN ambassador. Andy became Atlanta mayor. And as Atlanta mayor, he gentrified entire huge black neighborhoods in the center of town. If you drive I-75/85 through the heart of Atlanta right now, you'll see big skyscrapers on either side of you and monuments to the Olympics. And you'll see the dormitories of Georgia State University. All that used to be a black neighborhood. The Olympics, of course, does that everywhere it lands. That's why all the black people I know from Chicago, and I'm from Chicago, were overjoyed when the Olympics turned away from the south side of Chicago. You wouldn't know that from the media, though, of course. After Congress and after a couple of terms in the big chair of Atlanta City Hall, Andy Young established something called Good Works International. And he went to shill for Nike and a number of other international players. And he even became a close confidant of the kleptocrats who rule Nigeria. Beside that, he's been on the board of Barrick Gold and a number of the companies that are literally looting the Congo and which have been responsible for 6 million dead since the mid-90s in the Congo. So that's black advancement. We're international players now. Domestically, Atlanta's been ruled by black mayors since 1972. And these black mayors helped spawn and propagate a whole class of contractors and aspirants. They built Hartsfield International Airport, the biggest airport in the world now. And a lot of that was done by black contractors. One of the biggest contractors involved in that was a guy named H.K. Russell. I don't know if you've heard about him here in New York or not, but H.J. Russell is a big, big player around the country now in engineering and construction. And they're even at the lead of decimating more black neighborhoods in Atlanta to make room for more gentry. Black teachers 45 years ago were the civic backbone of black America, black public school teachers. They had the advantage of working near where they lived. Most of them lived in the neighborhoods where they taught. So they didn't have a long commute, an hour each way in the car, to waste. They got to spend all their working energies working with kids in the neighborhood, and they spent the rest of their energies in their churches and in their civic organizations. Where are black teachers now, 45 years later? Mostly fired, okay? Our black misleadership class has jumped on the charter school bandwagon, the school privatization bandwagon, a bandwagon that, as Glenn just told you, was ginned up by the Bradley Foundation, the Walton Family Foundation, the Gates Foundation, and other heavy right-wing players. 45 years later, our 6 or 7 black members of Congress is now a crew of 42. And rural land loss, it's over. We ain't got to worry about that no more. We done lost it. Gentrification is still happening. But the black political class is still riding high. What's dead is their mission. And it's time for us to worry about what comes after.
That was Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon. His panel included Ajamu Baraka, a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, and bar editor and columnist. Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, noted whistleblower and founder of the No Fear Coalition, and a bar columnist and editor. And Dr. Anthony Montero, professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia, and a longtime friend of Black Agenda Report. We regret that the audio of their presentations was damaged. Panel number 2 included Boyce Watkins, founder of the online publication Your Black World, and a professor of economics at Syracuse University, and Kevin Alexander Gray, the activist and author from Columbia, South Carolina. Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly led the discussion.
You know, this is a very interesting time for black people in particular, but also for humanity in general. Earlier today, I was just wondering if that typhoon in the Pacific had struck the damaged nuclear reactor in Fukushima, Japan, and I went online, and then I saw this headline in the New York Times. U.S. prepares to train African forces to fight terror. The Big Red One Infantry Division will conduct more than 100 missions in Africa over the next year. And the missions range from a 2-man sniper team in Burundi to 350 soldiers conducting airborne and humanitarian exercises in South Africa. Now, I don't know why Burundi needs a 2-man sniper team, but I do know that there was a time, as Glenn pointed out earlier, that the Congressional Black Caucus would have had something to say about AFRICOM. They were once the conscience of the Congress, but they are now like the rest, a misleadership class, beholden to moneyed interests, and even worse, addicted to a bizarre need to support a black president who isn't at all interested in supporting the needs of their constituents. We've talked a lot about Edward Snowden this evening, and when his case first made the news, a longtime member of the Black Caucus, Representative Clyburn of South Carolina, just dismissed him as someone who was making trouble for Obama, and who was this guy, and how did he get a security clearance? No concern about what Snowden revealed. No concern about the American people, just supporting this president. But it's ironic at this time that black people have so many of the outward trappings of success, the things that we always said would mean that we had, quote-unquote, made it. Black president, black Oscar winners, black millionaires, black people winning gold medals at the Winter Olympics, all kinds of things. But we have now simultaneously reached the nadir of our existence since the days of Jim Crow. And our country has reached its own nadir as millions of jobs have disappeared, entire industries no longer exist, and the budget deal that was recently reached will eventually result in the decimation of the safety net. And black members of Congress will help in that effort. As I've often said, they want to be supportive of the president more than they want anything else. So tonight we're joined by another excellent panel who will be talking about moving from misleadership to real leadership. Dr. Boyce Watkins from yourblackworld.net, great website. He's also a professor at Syracuse.
One thing we know about love is that love is not really rational. Love is not, it's not a logical process, right? It's a lot more like an addiction to cocaine. In fact, it affects the same part of the brain as cocaine does. And so when you're talking to somebody that's in love, you really can't win arguments with logic. In fact, logic will only make that person madder at you because you're confronting them with something that they don't want to believe, right? I do not want to believe that my president is XYZ. No, he is my wannabe baby daddy. He's the man of my dreams. I love him so much. Don't you say nothing bad about my Barack Obama. And so one of the things I noticed was that it was just really fickle to really even address what was going on in the White House on any level if you were in a public space, because you knew what the reactions were going to be. The great thing, though, over the last 5 years, I believe, is that because the relationship has been so revealing in so many ways in terms of really showing people what a black president really means, what any president means, and that skin color doesn't mean a whole lot, is that I think you're seeing people slowly gaining a political education. And they're starting to understand. For example, in 08, if we had a conversation about President Obama on Your Black World, it would go one way. You say one thing, you don't have to say anything critical. You say something that is not positive, we hate you, you're a hater, what's wrong with you, you're just jealous, you're mad because he gets all the attention, you don't, nobody's listening to you anymore, and we don't need Jesse Jackson anymore, who cares what you've done over the last 4 years, we love our president. Whereas now, you see a debate. You see folks kind of saying, well, you know, actually, let's talk about this. And you see actually people attacking from the other direction. So my argument has always been that, at least the position that I decided to take was, it's going to be very rare that I try to just confront what's happening in the White House directly. I don't think you can talk to individuals that are in love and use these kinds of arguments to really get them to understand where you're coming from. I do believe that human beings have a natural capacity to want the truth. I think they naturally gravitate toward the truth. And I think that by coexisting with whatever's happening in Washington and coexisting in a productive way can allow us to win the debate without even confronting the person that we know is serving to denigrate the people that we care about. And so, for example, if I want somebody to come and work with me and to start a business with me, and I know that they hate the corporate plantation, that they're being mistreated, they're being underpaid, they don't love their job, I'm not really going to spend a whole lot of time talking about the job they have and why they hate it. I'm really just going to say, well, let's look at the benefits of what we can do over here. And I find that approach, just showing this unapologetic love for black people, speaking the truth wherever it may lie, supporting the freedom of thought of black people, which has been severely oppressed since this president came into office, that you find people waking up and coming to their own conclusions in a positive way. One of the things that has been incredibly frustrating has been, maybe 07, 08, I worked a lot with certain people in this class. I don't know if they're leadership class or whatever these people are, the ones we see on MSNBC and all that. I worked with them because I didn't really understand the game that was being played. And, you know, as I moved away from it, you know, I started noticing that basically they're taking advantage of the fact that, for the most part, our society has been corporatized. We have gotten to the point where we worship money. If you look at what kinds of messages our children are being inundated with, they are messages that really teach you to worship money. And I'm a finance professor, so I know capitalism very well. I know capitalism better than a man knows his ex-wife. And I studied it because when I grew up, I didn't have any money, so I figured if I studied money and learned about money, somebody paid me money to talk about money. But the thing I learned also about capitalism is that in this society, we live in a capitalist democracy. That capitalism is I don't see it as a bad or a good thing. I see it as a powerful thing. Fire is powerful. Fire can cook your food and keep you warm, or it can burn you and your family alive. A drug can be powerful. A drug can either heal you and make you better, or it can turn you into an addict. Money can either liberate you, or it can turn you into a high-paid slave. We have a lot of celebrities with $500 million in the bank who are scared of their own shadow, scared to take a stand on anything because they're afraid of losing money. That's sick. I'm like, what the hell are you afraid of, Jay-Z? You have more money than Jesus. So my thinking is that in order to fight this battle, in order to fight this beast, I don't think we can avoid the beast of capitalism. I don't think we can run away from the beast. I don't think we can kill the beast. I really don't. I don't know if we can, but I don't know if we should. I don't know if we can. I'm not here to say that. But my thought was that maybe it's okay to try to see if we can ride the beast. And what I mean by that is Capitalism is not what kills, what's killing America. And just in case you don't know, economically, America is on its way to a slow death. Our value systems have eroded. If you look at what's going on in our government, we've got people that will let people die so that they can avoid paying an extra 0.5% in taxes. I mean, that's sick. You look at what's going on with the deficit. That's unsustainable. Every 6 months, we have a budget crisis. We're this close to defaulting. We are in trouble, and it's not going to get better. There's no indicator I see right now that says that our situation as a country is going to improve economically, nothing at all. But I don't see capitalism as the beast. I see greed as the beast. I see unregulated capitalism as the beast. Because the thing is, when you allow capitalism to exist in an unregulated fashion, as we did during the administrations of Clinton and Bush, then you have things like what you saw on Wall Street. You know, with this excessive risk-taking and all these things that destroyed our economy. You have a scenario where you got people literally getting to that point where they literally engage in some sort of really sick financial gluttony. And I think that that's what's really destroyed the soul of our people. But given that we're in this capitalist bath, and I'm going to finish with this point, I would argue, at least this is the strategy I've been taking with Your Black World, is in my goal to educate the people, and I'm an educator by heart, and a lot of my friends are scholars and whatnot, and I'm trying to help them get off the plantation so they can get out and really do what they're supposed to do, which is teaching their community instead of going to the big white university that pays them the most money. I try to figure out how we can raise money, how we can make money, how we can set up ethical and responsible business models to make our activism sustainable. Because it's easier for me to get somebody to get out here and fight the good fight with me when I can say, look, don't worry about it. You know, this job is not going to make you rich, but I can at least make sure that your kids are fed, that you have a place to live, and you won't have to quit to go back to the corporate plantation you came from because you ran out of money. And so I think that when we're talking about raising money for very powerful initiatives like the Black Agenda Report, I think that maybe we should look at these broader economic models so that we can create scenarios that are economically sustainable so that we can use the tools of capitalism to confront people in the battle that we're in. Because if you try to fight a battle on a capitalist field and you don't understand capitalism, it's a lot like trying to win a football game by playing basketball. It ain't going to work. You can win by playing better basketball, maybe a more responsible style of basketball. And so, because think about this. Our minds, if you look at the way our minds are enslaved as black people, you can point right back to the capitalist entities that control the things that our people absorb. Number one, enemy number one, Clear Channel and BET. They put all that shit on the radio that tells all our kids, all our young boys to grow up hating women and wanting to bling and ball and floss and shine and kill each other and get high on drugs and all these other stupid things. And so the question is, how do you deal with that? How do you confront that? Maybe you get the money so you can push messages that counter what they're hearing on the radio every day. If you look at what's happening with MSNBC, all they're doing is they're just marketing a message that people are buying into. And again, when you're talking to black folks, you're talking to people that are in love. You're talking to people who are used to living on faith. Faith means that even when every piece of logic points to the contrary, my faith tells me that it's still going to be okay, or that Barack is still a good guy, even though all the evidence points in the other direction. So ultimately, at the end of the day, if we're going to solve these problems in a 21st century format, in the 21st century framework, we got to come up with 21st century solutions. That means that we have to rethink everything from the bottom up and the top down. And the first rule, number one, is that every person of color is not our friend. If we don't know that by now, then we should know it already.
That was Dr. Boyce Watkins of Syracuse University. Next up, Kevin Alexander Gray. He's author of the book Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics.
I just have to say honestly that I never expected anything out of Barack Obama. I can't say I'm disappointed because I never expected anyone that would lead an empire to do anything other than lead an empire. Back in 2008, I believe it was, I wrote a piece for Black Agenda Report and Counterpunch called The Novocaine Presidency. And we're coming up on the anniversary of Malcolm X's message to the grassroots when he talked about going to the dentist and the dentist sticking some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine. And there you are, you're sitting in a chair and blood's trickling down your jaw and you sit there and you suffer peacefully. And that's what racial solidarity has done, to engage the idea of how bad President Obama has been is to ignore our failure, is to ignore the fact that we haven't done the organizing that we need to do. The fact that we continue to want to, as Reverend Jackson used to say, and which he does a lot himself, want to ride to freedom on Pharaoh's chariot. That's not going to happen. We have to start figuring out what are the independent mechanisms that we can create to build a new movement. How do we set up those freedom schools to train the organizers? How do we fund those schools that train organizers? How do we get the people in the community to fight back against their pain? The pain isn't new. Mass incarceration isn't new. Now, you know, I got a whole lot of things behind my name, too, like, you know, Right for Counterpunch, President ACLU. My dad went in the Navy in 1940 and spent 27 years in the Navy because he thought he had to join the military to get out of the circumstances of the South. Meanwhile, his two brothers went to jail for murder. I got three brothers. Progress. My brother, three brothers, only went to jail for burglary and drugs. It's progress. So it's not like people, you know, you go back and look at the numbers, it's not like they just started putting black folk in jail and killing black folk last week. It's not like they just started stop and frisk and shooting black folk last week. It's just now so bad, because what, a couple of weeks ago in Arkansas, that they'll even send in SWAT on a 107-year-old black man to show you how much power they got. It's not new. It's not new. I went in the military. My brothers went in the military. Went to fight and kill other people that did nothing to us. Because that's the option that our kids have. They have an option of blingism and capitalism, which I don't know. I don't know how many black folk are capitalism. They have no capital. I guess I'd be a capitalist if I had some capital. Yeah, you know, you got to have some capital to be. And this whole struggle for black people and for people of color, if you weren't the subject of genocide like the Native Americans, has been the denial of access to capital and credit, due process of law, and equal treatment under the law. That's what our movement should be about. It shouldn't be about organizations. And as I said, I've managed Jesse Jackson's campaign. I work with the NAACP. I work with a lot of organizations. But we know that Wells Fargo, Bank of America, everybody sends those cats a check. And that's who they listen to. Why would they listen to us? We're not paying them to represent us or to carry our water. Since Dr. King died, when Dr. King died, what, there were 100 black elected officials in this country. Now there are over 10,000. And people talk about Cory Booker. Well, you know, we have a black senator in South Carolina, too.
That's right.
You forgot about Tim Scott. We have a black Republican. You know, every time I get to thinking, or anybody tells me, well, this racism is bad in America, I'm from South Carolina. I'll drive down to Bull Street, named after the general that warned the people that Denmark Vesey was planning a revolt. I'll ride down to the state capitol on the Robert E. Lee Highway and look at the Confederate flag. I'll go down to Calhoun Street, the man that invented the terms nullification and interposition, and I know what country I'm in. I know what state I'm in. It's truth in advertising. So we've got to build a movement. We've got, you know, Barack Obama, the misleadership class, Kasim Reed, Corey. Because we talk about Corey, but Corey's predecessor wasn't that great either. Sharp James. Was he? And I love Jesse, Reverend Jackson, and me and Boyce do his show. They bring us on the show to say the things that they can't say. And if we say too much, they don't call us back. Is that right? All right, okay, and Reverend Al. And as it relates to, I'm in New York, as it relates to Reverend Al and the president. Anytime that Reverend Al is promoted as the leader of the black community, we know we got problems. Everybody know Reverend Al's history. Everybody knows that Reverend Al's history, you know. And I'm going to leave it alone because I know I'm in his hometown. Like the farce on Washington, what Malcolm called it, and having sponsored by Bank of America and MSNBC to promote garbage. So we've got to call, we do have to call that out. But we've got to start organizing our people. Glenn is right. We've got to go into the prisons. We've got to organize the people in the prisons, and we've got to organize their families outside the prison. We've got to talk about freedom schools, as I said, to educate our people. We got to start organizing people fighting against this alienation that comes from gentrification. When they move the people out to cities and they move them into these subprime houses that none of them kept, then where do they go? And then we're in a culture where we tell them, well, it's your fault. And we're in a culture where rappers and we older people have to confront this, are feeding the community garbage. They're feeding them this idea of capitalism and blingism and the facsimile of luxury. And this idea that what they need to achieve in life is wealth and capitalism and blingism and more, 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 and greed. When I was coming up, and I heard somebody say it earlier, when we were coming up in the South in the 60s and 70s, when our communities were intact, because, you know, we can't even define, how do we define a black community right now that's scattered all over the place? How do we define that? And when we talk about unity, what does that mean? Everybody talks about unity and racial solidarity. People are unified behind Barack Obama to go kill people, more people, that we don't know. People are unified behind Barack Obama in an assassination program. And nobody even talks about the Africans that were killed in Libya. No one even mentions that. So what are we unified for? What are we fighting for? Are we fighting for capitalism? Are we fighting to change the structures? We're talking about doing away with the banks. We're really talking about attacking capitalism. So what does that mean? When we look at what's going on in this so-called farce of a debate about Obamacare, I started calling it the Affordable Care Act because, it's not Obamacare. It ought to be something that people embrace. But the reality is we should have been arguing for single payer, and we shouldn't have never given up on that. And in one respect, this failure of a program, because the people in this room who have health insurance don't even know what the people who are signing up for that program are going through. Don't even really understand the program. And then in the South, the people who really need the health care are being cut out because they can't qualify for Medicaid. And they're in these GOP states in the South where the majority of African Americans live, where there's very little organizing going on, and where the NAACP and black legislators negotiate with the GOP for their seats that they have forever. So we do have to talk about a new politic, but we got to be clear about that new politic. And it does mean that we can't be servants to the Democratic Party. I'm certain that not many people in here are servants to the Republican Party. Although, you know, I edited two newspapers in which the publishers were both Republicans, and I asked them, why, you know, what's this, how do black people become Republicans? And they say, the line is shorter. The line is shorter. Everybody getting paid. So we've got to talk about what our movement's about. We've got to talk about what kind of country we want. How do we make an economically sustainable country, which means that we do have to talk out in the open about socialism. And we do have to talk about defeating capitalism, which is basically based on greed and based on exploitation. It's what these kids' music is totally based on. I'm going to sell some dope. I'm going to hook up with my bitch. I'm going to get busted. I'm going to go to jail. I'm going to get out and sing about it some more. We got to stop that. Music that has no content to the future of our people. We got to challenge that. So I really appreciate Black Agenda Report. I always have. I write for Black Agenda Report and Progressive and Counterpunch. But Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report are the two places where if it's edited, you're edited because they won't. You can say what you want to say. And for the record, I'm glad that Black Agenda Report, you know, I think every now and then it's like, you know what, we need to challenge our own people. Obama is going to be Obama. What we have to worry about, a young friend of mine in Atlanta was telling me, well, you know, he's got a future ahead of him. Maybe he'll get out, leave office, and he'll be like Jimmy Carter. And he'll, someone told me, and you know what, that's a thought. Because people will buy into this idea of skin privilege, black skin privilege, light skin privilege, and Barack Obama being something that he is not. Barack Obama, and people get mad, it's like, man, you know, he's black. He said he was black. But Barack Obama grew up in Hawaii and went to Indonesia. And I grew up in South Carolina. I don't know what growing up in Indonesia, I mean, of course, I'm sure there are oppressed people in Indonesia. But they weren't in the South in the 60s. And Barack Obama is, he's the head of the empire. He's the figurehead of the empire. He's the figurehead of the empire. It's like Malcolm said, he's there to appease the masses, to make them feel good for those black people, and there are a lot of them in this country, that what they want is white folks' acceptance. That's what they want. And he represents that for them. Cory Booker represents that for him. All these folk that will bend over and they'll go fight and kill a stranger because they want to be accepted by this monster that we live in. That's what we got to fight. But we got to organize our community in the same way that the Tea Party, I have a lot of respect for folk that they believe what they believe. Now, I know they believe that the government's giving niggas everything they want. That's basically it. They mad, you know, those lazy black folk. It's like the slave master always thought the slave picking the cotton out in the field was lazy. He was sitting on the porch, but the slave was lazy. We know that the linchpin of modern capitalism is slavery, and we ought to be focused on that, be focused on demanding that this government pay its debt to the descendants of enslaved Africans, that we not give up this idea of reparations if we have to deal with this idea of class. We know, well, if we're going to, if whites and our allies are going to accept this idea of reparations and housing for everybody and free public education, then maybe we can do some talking on this idea of reparation and the debt. But we can never, you know, it might not, it's like the second coming for people that believe. It may never come, but they believe in it. We've got to stay focused on what we believe in, on the debt that this nation owes to people that built this country, on the debt that established the foundation of modern capitalism in this world. We got to demand that this government stop going to war. The missing element in all this discussion about the debt and the debt ceiling was all the money that we spend in the military. The fact that we spend $1.5 million per troop, per tour in all these countries that we've been fighting in. We've got to stay focused on our message and forget about the message of the empire.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray at Black Agenda Report's 7th anniversary celebration at Riverside Church in New York City. We are indebted to Stan Heller and Economic Uprising for the audio. Finally, this week, we thought it appropriate to bring back Bar Managing Editor Bruce Dixon. He has a commentary on the black misleadership class and the plight of black higher education.
Historically, black colleges and universities constitute 3% of America's colleges, but produce 20% of black graduates, 50% of black public school teachers and lawyers, and 80% of black judges and 90% of black BAs. If there is a talented tenth, the phrase W.E.B. Du Bois coined a century ago to denote the black elite whose successes will supposedly enable them to lift up the other 90% of us, its beating heart lives in those black colleges and universities. But the first black president is no fan of historically black colleges and universities. Back in 2011, the Obama administration, more in tune with what its Wall Street contributors want than what its voting constituents desire, made student loans significantly more difficult to obtain. The Obama administration's new policies immediately caused 28,000 mostly African American students to drop out of historically black colleges alone for lack of funds to continue their education, and it denied historically black colleges and universities a crucial $150 million a year in revenue. In the 2 years since, the colleges have begged for the restoration of the old rules on college loans, but to no avail. The Obama administration has compounded the injury by releasing what it calls college scorecards, which rank schools by graduation rate at a time when poorer students are dropping out in huge numbers nationwide due to economic stress. Under these circumstances, the only way for historically black colleges to survive is to do the impossible, to attract ever wealthier students at a time when overall black family incomes are dropping. This is a financial crisis that HBCU trustees across the country know they cannot survive unless something changes. Many have noted that during the past 2 years, if these things had happened under a Bush-Cheney administration, the black colleges, their alumni, and the traditional civil rights organization would have been in federal court a long time ago. But the black misleadership class's true causes are the careers of its own members and seeking the favor of those in power. So despite the title of an otherwise pretty good New Republic article called Why Black Colleges Might Sue the Obama Administration, black colleges suing a black president to restore their college loan funding is just never, never, never going to happen. What's their alternative? Jared L. Carter of HBCU Digest is absolutely in tune with a large section of this class when he suggests that Condoleezza Rice be named the next president of Howard University, bringing her blood-stained Rolodex of contacts from the board of Chevron, which once named a double-hoiled oil tanker after her, and her record of lying and genocidal warfare around the world into that office. Rice, he contends, can sell corporations on the proposition that investing in, basically taking over, the cream of historically black colleges and universities will somehow benefit them. How any of this uplifts more than the tiniest fraction of African Americans who become the admirals, generals, and corporate fixers is unclear. Those are the choices our black misleadership class sees for historically black colleges and universities. They can roll over and die, or they can shut up and sell out. This is the corner they've led themselves into. This is why we call them the black misleadership class.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will be back next week. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.